All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Deep Dive. You know, one of the coolest things we get to do on this show is really get into the nitty-gritty of some Supreme Court cases. And today, we're diving into one that's, well, let's just say it's a real head-scratcher. Murray v. Carrier from way back in 1986. I think for anyone out there trying to really grasp federal habeas corpus and the whole concept of procedural default, this case is a must-read, must-understand.
You hit the nail right on the head. I mean, for all you law students listening especially, Murray v. Carrier basically lays down the law on when a lawyer's slip-up, even an honest mistake, can actually shut the door on a client's chance to get their constitutional claims reviewed in federal court after they've gone through the state system. It's really a stark illustration of the balancing act courts have to do between respecting the finality of those state court decisions and, you know, at the same time, making sure that every individual gets a fair shot under the Constitution.
And, you know, just to add to the intrigue, this wasn't some cut and dry, everybody agrees kind of decision. We had Justice Brennan writing a pretty fiery dissent, and he was really worried that the majority's ruling could really chip away at the foundation of fairness in our justice system. So today, our goal, our deep dive mission, is to really break this case down piece by piece. We're going to get into the specifics of what happened, the court's reasoning, and how this case, even though it's from decades ago, how it's still shaping federal habeas review today.
Okay, let's do it. So back in 1977, a guy named Clifford Carrier gets convicted in a Virginia state court. Pretty serious charges, rape and abduction. Even before the trial kicks off, though, Carrier's lawyer makes a move. He files a pretrial motion asking the court to force the prosecution to hand over any statements the victim made to the police. The thinking, well, maybe those statements have some inconsistencies that could help Carrier's defense.
Makes sense. So what happens next? The trial judge does what's called an in-camera review of those statements, meaning the judge takes a look at them privately, the defense isn't there for this part, to figure out if there's any exculpatory information, right? Anything that might point towards Carrier not being guilty. After looking everything over, the judge decides, nope, there's nothing there that meets that standard, and denies the motion to disclose those statements.
So then we jump ahead to the appeals process. Carrier gets convicted, and his attorney files that notice of appeal, right? And that initial notice lists out 7 alleged errors, things that went wrong during the trial. One of those 7, you guessed it, that whole issue about not getting access to the victim's police statements.
So this is where things get a little dicey, right? And where a big mistake happens. Because even though the attorney put that discovery claim in the initial notice of appeal, when he files the formal petition for appeal with the Virginia Supreme Court, the document where you spell out exactly what you're appealing, that claim about the victim's statements just vanishes. It's just not there.
I know, right? Poof. Gone. It's like the legal equivalent of forgetting to attach a crucial document to an important email, only, you know, with potentially life-altering consequences. I mean, to have a core part of your appeal just disappear between filing the notice and the actual petition, it's a pretty glaring mistake, and it just shows you how high the stakes can be.
And in this case, the stakes were high. That omission, forgetting to include that claim in the formal petition, had a real domino effect. You see, Virginia, like a lot of states, has really specific procedural rules for appeals. And one of those rules says that the state Supreme Court, they're only going to look at the errors you specifically lay out in that formal petition for appeal. So because that claim about the victim's statements wasn't in there, the Virginia Supreme Court basically said, sorry, not sorry, you didn't raise this the right way, so we're not going to touch it.
That's procedural default in a nutshell, isn't it? It's like a legal technicality, but a really powerful one. The whole idea is sometimes you can lose the opportunity to have your constitutional claims heard in federal court if your lawyer messed up on the rules back in state court. It doesn't even matter if the claim has merit. The court just won't even look at it.
It's almost like, I don't know, missing a filing deadline, right? You might have a great argument, but if you're late, well, tough luck. So Carrier, having hit that dead end in the state appeals process, decides to take his case to federal court.
Yeah.
He files a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. Now, for anyone who needs a little refresher, habeas corpus is that legal procedure where someone who's detained can challenge whether their detention is even legal in the first place. In this petition, Carrier argues that the state trial court, by refusing to hand over those victim statements, violated a big Supreme Court case, Brady v. Maryland.
Yeah, Brady, that's the landmark case that says prosecutors, they've got to turn over any evidence that might help the defendant, anything exculpatory. So Carrier is basically saying, hey, those police statements, those should have been turned over under Brady.
But the federal district court, they didn't buy it. They essentially said, look, you already procedurally defaulted on that Brady claim back in state court. You didn't raise it properly when you went to the Virginia Supreme Court, so you can't just spring it on us here in federal court. Mm-hmm. It seemed like Carrier was out of luck. Another dead end.
But wait, there's a twist. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, they actually reversed that decision, saying, hold on, what if the attorney's mistake, leaving that claim out, what if it was just an oversight, you know, a simple whoops, not some calculated strategy? They thought maybe that kind of unintentional error should excuse the procedural default. So for a minute there, Carrier had a glimmer of hope. The Fourth Circuit seemed to be saying, hey, your lawyer's mistake might not be fatal to your case.
And, you know, it's this kind of disagreement between lower courts, these different interpretations, that often sends a case straight up to the Supreme Court, which is precisely what happened here.
Right. So now the Supreme Court has to tackle the big question. Can a lawyer's unintentional error, just a plain old mistake, be enough of a cause to excuse a procedural default in a federal habeas corpus case? I mean, does oops, I messed up really give you a second chance in federal court?
And the Supreme Court's answer, a resounding no. Pretty definitive. They ruled that these garden variety attorney errors, the ones that aren't intentional strategies but just slip-ups, those are not enough to clear that cause hurdle you need to get around a procedural default.
Okay, so no simple my bad excuses. But then the court goes on to say, all right, here's what would count as cause. They say it's got to be objective factors external to the defense. Think, you know, the state somehow interfering, preventing the attorney from raising a claim, or in some very, very specific situations, maybe ineffective assistance of counsel. But even then, there's a really, really high bar to clear.
They didn't stop there, though. They added a very narrow exception, right? The court said, even if you can't show cause, a federal court might still look at your claim, but only if you can prove you're actually innocent. It's a pretty big if.
Big if indeed. So let's break down the majority opinion. Justice O'Connor is writing for the court, and she really leans into the idea of comity. Basically, that's the idea that state and federal courts, they need to respect each other's turf, their processes, and their decisions. The court's worried about stepping on the toes of state courts, undermining their authority, especially when it comes to those procedural rules. And then they also talk a lot about the need for finality, letting those state court judgments stand, creating that sense that a decision has been made, it's done, and we need to move on.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Imagine if any lawyer mistake was a free pass to retry a case in federal court. What would that do to the state court system? You know, those state procedural rules would become more like, what, guidelines, suggestions? If you knew you could always go to federal court and say, oops, I forgot to include that argument, there would be no real reason to follow the rules carefully in the first place.
And there's another piece here that's really important. The court clarifies how those ineffective assistance of counsel claims, how they work in all this. Let's say a prisoner's arguing that their lawyer was so bad that was the reason they missed some deadline or didn't raise a key issue in state court. Well, they can't just waltz into federal court and use that as an excuse for their procedural default. They have to have gone through the proper channels first, right? They had to have raised that ineffective assistance claim in state court and let the state courts rule on it. Only then can they use it as a potential cause in federal court.
It's like a prerequisite, right? Got to check that box in state court first. So this brings us to what's often called the cause and prejudice test, the framework federal courts use to decide if they'll excuse a procedural default. And Murray, well, it really solidified this test. So first, you got to prove cause. We've talked about that. You need to point to something outside the defense that prevented you from raising your claim in state court. Maybe the state withheld evidence. Maybe, just maybe, you can use ineffective assistance of counsel if you've already gone through that whole process in state court. Think of cause, like, why wasn't this claim raised in the first place?
Exactly. But even if you nail that cause part, you're not done. You also got to show prejudice. That means showing that the errors at trial, those weren't just minor hiccups. They were so big, they messed up the whole trial, created real constitutional error. It's not enough to say a mistake was made. You have to convince that federal court the mistake likely changed the whole outcome. It's got to be a game changer, not just a minor foul.
Right. It's about showing the real impact of the error, not just that it existed. But like we said before, there's that very narrow escape hatch, that backdoor exception in cases where someone can prove actual innocence. Even if you can't prove both cause and prejudice for your procedural default, if you've got brand new solid evidence that makes it look like you really didn't do the crime, well, then a federal court might take another look. It's a long shot for sure, but it's there to prevent the worst case scenario, a truly innocent person being locked up, because of some procedural technicality.
And Justice O'Connor, she sums it up really neatly in one sentence. She writes, "The perpetrator of a procedural default must bear the risk of attorney error." But of course, there's that caveat, that exception. Unless that attorney error is so bad, so incompetent, that it meets the incredibly high bar for ineffective assistance of counsel, the standard from Strickland v. Washington.
You know, it's important to remember, this wasn't some kumbaya, everybody agrees kind of decision. Justice Brennan, he wrote a really powerful dissent. His whole point was, look, these unintentional attorney errors, the honest mistakes, those shouldn't be a total roadblock to federal court review. Especially, he argued, in cases where someone's life is on the line, like death penalty cases. He felt really strongly that following state procedural rules to the letter shouldn't be more important than potentially preventing someone from being wrongly convicted. It's about justice, right?
Right, and we also have Justice Stevens. He ultimately agrees to send the case back to the lower court, but even he has some serious concerns about the majority's opinion. He's worried about that cause and prejudice test being used too rigidly, too strictly, you know, like, what about basic fairness? What about flexibility when it seems like a real injustice might have happened? He makes the point that habeas corpus review, that should be an option in those really strong cases where it seems very likely someone's innocent, even if they can't perfectly check all those cause and prejudice boxes.
That's a good point. So, what's the big takeaway from Murray v. Carrier? Why is this a case that's worth a whole deep dive?
Well, like we said at the beginning, it's a major gatekeeper for federal habeas corpus review. It makes it much, much harder to get a federal court to look at your claims if you didn't raise them properly in state court.
And for you law students, man, there are some big lessons here. Lesson number one, you got to make sure you're raising every possible legal claim in state court. And you got to do it the right way, following all those procedural rules, dotting your I's and crossing your T's. Because if you don't, even if it's just an innocent mistake, it can really hurt your client down the road. It might even completely block them from ever getting their constitutional claims heard in federal court.
Lesson number two. If you're thinking about arguing ineffective assistance of counsel as the cause for a procedural default, remember, you can't just spring that on the federal court. You've got to raise that specific claim about your client's previous lawyer messing up. You've got to raise that in state court first and let them deal with it. And lastly, that actual innocence exception, yeah, it's there, but it's a last resort. You're only going to use that in those super rare cases where there's powerful new evidence that practically screams your client is innocent. Don't expect it to be an easy win. Federal courts don't just hand those out.
So at the end of the day, what Murray v. Carrier really shows us is the Supreme Court making a choice, a policy decision. They decided to make state judicial systems and their final judgments the priority. To protect those systems, even if that means some potentially valid constitutional claims might never get a full hearing in federal court because a lawyer made a mistake.
And, you know, like Justice Brennan argued, that's not the only way to look at this. He saw this decision as really undermining the whole point of habeas corpus. You know, habeas corpus is there to be a check on the states to make sure they're respecting people's constitutional rights in those criminal cases. He worried that putting procedural rules above everything else, above justice, could lead to some really unfair outcomes. And Justice Stevens, he pushed for a more balanced approach, one that keeps fairness front and center, especially when it looks like someone might actually be innocent.
It's a tough question, isn't it? You've got these competing values, following the rules and making sure justice is done. It really makes you think, where do you draw the line? Where do you stand on that balance?
Well, for our next deep dive, we're going to switch gears a little bit and look at another Supreme Court case that deals with this procedural default issue, Coleman v. Thompson. It really builds on some of the things we've talked about today in Murray, and it had its fair share of controversy, a divided court, so it should be a good one.
Absolutely. And you know, for all those future lawyers out there listening, Murray v. Carrier has a really clear practical message for you. Be careful, be meticulous, and double check everything you file. Make sure you're hitting every deadline, raising every claim, and crossing every T and dotting every I. Because even a little mistake, something that seems minor, could have huge permanent consequences for your client and their constitutional rights. So be careful out there.